A very good morning from Wattle Partners and welcome to the Market Thinkers series. 12 sessions running from today until Christmas. We've had a great turnout for this one. Thanks for everyone for logging on. We were planning to run this from our office in a more professional studio. However, Melbourne being shut down and locked down, we decided to not postpone again, and we're delighted to welcome you to the first session. However, we are from home, so don't mind the dogs and the cats and the kids and the wife and the postman that turns up every 20 minutes and every other distraction. Given the reshuffle, our first session will be around the Magellan Infrastructure Fund. So first, why the Market Thinkers series? As you know, we write a lot. We even talk more. But sometimes it's hard for us to demystify a line in a portfolio that has a certain name. And historically, we've done seminars and roundtables. Of course, roundtables have been mainly limited to the Melbourne office. But we thought this was a great way to introduce you to the people that we know, the people that are making investment decisions on your behalf. And we trust with your capital. So the first session, we're very privileged to have Gerald Stack from Magellan Financial Group, who is the head of the decorated Magellan Infrastructure Fund, managing over $16 billion. And the lockdown even should make this conversation even more interesting, given there's no cars on the toll roads, there's no planes in the airports, and Gerald owns both those assets. So welcome, Gerald. Welcome.
Thanks, Jamie. Thanks. First, for having
me. No problem. First, before we get going into questions, let me just talk about the format of the next 45 minutes. Drew, which is still blank on the other side, which I'm a bit worried about, is going to ask a few questions about people and product, who you are and what your fund does and how it does it. And then we're going to go into 10 quick questions, 10 quick questions, which again will highlight who you are. Essentially after the 10 questions, we'll go into 30 to 35 minutes of deeper questions. Now, this is designed to be interactive. So everyone that's on the call, feel free to ask any questions throughout the period and we'll relay the questions to Gerald. So over to you, Drew.
Thanks, Jamie. I think just to set the scene, it's probably good to focus back on, you know, the purpose of Magellan and why we look for infrastructure. I think the last kind of 3 months and since the economic shutdowns have started, we've seen incomes become even more important. There's been dividend cuts across the ASX, across the banking sector, across almost every sector. And then we've also seen RBA rate cuts with term deposit rates now below 1% in most cases for a few years. So even before this all started, we were always looking for some alternative sources of income, and that naturally led us towards infrastructure assets. If you look back in history, they've always provided fairly regulated income over a long period of time. So in the past, we've invested directly, so by the ASX in things like Macquarie Airports or Australian Infrastructure. And whilst they're all great companies, and I think we generally made money from them, they don't really offer much global diversification. And as we know, Australia is something like 3% of the world, and the same for infrastructure. So that led us to the Magellan Infrastructure Fund. There are a few alternatives in the market. It only invests into listed infrastructure, so on stock exchanges around the world, but it still holds real assets. So the things in the portfolio include airports, toll roads, gas pipelines, I think railways, but maybe Gerald can go into a bit more detail on that, telecommunications towers, and other sorts of even renewable energy assets as well. So all very monopolistic assets with pretty solid income returns, at least until recently. I think now is probably a good time to introduce Gerald. If you could provide a bit of a summary on your career, the time at Magellan. I think maybe I was reading that you're actually the chairman of the investment committee of Magellan. Is that correct?
Hey, Drew. Yeah, look, that is correct. A small firm like Magellan, we all wear many hats. I've been around Magellan since 2000, January 2007, I joined. And that was just one of the hats that I got placed with early on, given early on.
Was that the start of Magellan, 2007?
Yeah, well, Magellan really started in late 2006. There was an initial public offering of what was then the Magellan Flagship Fund, now MFF Capital. There was a listing of the management company Magellan. Our trusts, the Magellan Infrastructure Fund and the Magellan Global Fund, started on the 1st of July 2007. And as I like to say, if nothing else, that what that proves is that market timing's not really our thing. So it was a period of, you know, a lot of volatility, pretty stressful. Not necessarily a lot of certainty at that time, but what we did have a belief in our underlying thesis really in terms of investment is that what we're trying to invest in, both in global equities and in infrastructure, is investments that have fundamentally reliable, predictable returns. We talk a lot about quality, and quality for us is really about the reliability and predictability of those income streams over time. And that held up through that period, I think you'd have to say.
How big's the research team at Magellan?
So our total investment team, sort of 36 people, I think, and there are three dealers, so that leaves 33, and I think there's one other person who we wouldn't say is research. So it's 32 in the research, so investment in research, if you like.
Yeah, so not small.
No, not small, but not massive. I mean, there are certainly global investors with bigger teams than us. I don't think ultimately we're not trying to be the biggest. What we're trying to do is focus on those areas where we believe we have a circle of competence. You hear Hamish talk about that a lot. And from the earliest days, we thought there was really three things: franchises, and we've broken franchises down over time to mean a range of different sectors. But franchises, financials, and infrastructure are the three key areas. Now, within franchises, we've taken tech, communications, and media, and made it its own separate team. Same with healthcare. We've broken that down a little bit, but those three sectors were the core of what we believed our thesis brought something to the table, and we continue to believe that today.
What would your typical day look like in a?
Yeah, well,
when you're not working from home, but
these days it's get up and go straight to my desk. We manage global money, obviously. So really the first thing I do in the morning is when I come in is look at our universe of companies. It's about 130 of those, and look at what's gone on overnight, and sort of just go through the news to make sure where there's nothing unusual or unexpected. So utilities are a good example of this. Utilities generally have a fairly high level of correlation across that segment of the market. But that doesn't mean that every company is going to be doing exactly the same thing. So you're looking for the outliers up or down, just to see what it is that's driving those the outliers, and if there's a piece of knowledge there that you weren't aware of. So that's what I'm doing first thing, looking across our stocks, particularly our portfolio, but looking across our stocks and our sectors, just trying to understand what's happened overnight. Now, clearly one night's not going to drive your investment thesis, but I'm looking for those pieces of information that are additive to our current state of being. Then we have a meeting of our team around about 8:30, our infrastructure investment team. And we, again, go through, each of the guys has particular sectors and regions that they're focused on. They have sort of responsibility for managing the coverage. And we'll go through each of what they've seen, what's the news flow in respect to those sectors and regions overnight, and what does that, bring to the table? What's additive? What's different to what we expected?
So Gerald, you mentioned you have your universe is 130 stocks, but essentially in the fund you have between 20 and 40, don't you?
Yeah, exactly. So typically we're around about the 30 mark. We always talk 20 to 40. It gives us a build, and that tells you a little bit about the flex. Over the last 5 years, we've been anywhere between 28 and 33 stocks. So it's typically around about the 30 stock mark. And what we're trying to do by having a portfolio of that size is to have some benefits from diversification, but as well have meaningful exposure to those things that we find particularly attractive, you know, high quality income streams, but are at attractive prices. Now, infrastructure by its nature is not as complex as, say, the tech companies, the Alphabets, Amazons of this world. So it tends to be a simpler universe, and therefore you don't expect significant price dislocation from long-term value. But it does happen every now and again. And when we find those opportunities, then we want to have a meaningful participation in the portfolio in them. So that's what we're looking for. And then across our portfolio, what we're trying to do is to come up with a portfolio that not only has that meaningful exposure, but is relatively well diversified across sectors, across geographies, so that ultimately we can deliver very reliable, predictable returns over time. Infrastructure, as we see it, should deliver you about inflation plus 5. So let's call inflation 2. It means a total return of about 7. Probably about half of that return today is income, and about half of that return is capital, but that will ebb and flow over time. And you know, we should be reasonably confident over the longer term that that's the sort of returns that we're going to deliver. And that's consistent with what we've done over time. We've done around about 8 and a bit percent, somewhere between 8 and 9%. Since inception, and you know, since inception we've had the GFC, we've now had the pandemic, so notwithstanding those two crises along the way, we've delivered inflation plus 5 plus a little bit on top of that, and that's probably what, you
know, slow down, Gerald, they're all our questions later on in the session. You're answering them. Just to warm up, we thought we'd ask you 10 quick fire questions that sure. We're looking for really short, quick responses from. So
personal, are you ready? Personal questions as well, so it doesn't have to be the firm, the Magellan view.
You can pass if you want to.
No problem.
Okay, you ready?
Yeah.
All right. You can only hold one stock for the next 10 years. What is it?
Transurban.
The one red flag for every investment?
Agency risk, you know, bad management governance issues.
What's the best stock you've ever bought?
Magellan.
Good one. Pineapple on pizza, yes or no?
I'm ambivalent. Probably a no.
We often get the response that if there's pineapple on pizza, it's a cake. Biggest regret or worst investment decision?
Worst investment decision, not necessarily biggest regret, but certainly worst investment decision was while I was at uni. So this is back in the late 80s. A group of us put together a sort of investment club, if you like, and invested in very poor quality things. And I learned very early on that you really better know what you're putting your money into. It was a powerful lesson, but they were pretty ordinary investments.
Great. Best investment for Armageddon, gold, crypto, cash, or government bonds?
I'd lean towards cash. Don't understand crypto. I need something that produces a yield of some sort, so I don't understand gold either. So for me, it's between cash and bonds, and I like liquidity, so cash.
Great. Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, or TikTok?
Yeah, probably. LinkedIn really is the only one that I'm a part of today.
We'll go LinkedIn. Yeah. Best region to invest in today: US, Asia, Europe, or Latin America?
Generally the US.
First overseas trip post-pandemic?
Yeah, so for work, it'll probably be the US. For play, it'll probably be New Zealand.
And the last one, beef, chicken, fish, or beyond meat?
Fish.
Fish, okay.
There you go.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Back to the investment part. I think probably the best starting point is the fact that you only invest in listed infrastructure, so assets listed on stock exchanges. Can you provide some kind of background in why you went along that approach? I know a lot of alternatives have some unlisted, and kind of the benefits compared to the way a pension fund like Australian Super would invest into infrastructure.
Yeah. Okay. So to give you a little bit of background to me, I started off my career as a chartered accountant and then moved into unlisted infrastructure investment for what was then Australian Industry Development Corporation, AIDC, which was part owned by the government and part listed on the Australian Stock Exchange. And there I was part of a team that was investing in unlisted infrastructure projects. So that's my investment career, started in unlisted. I then went from there to a firm known as Capital Partners. And Capital Partners, we were advisors to begin with on both listed and unlisted infrastructure. We advised pension funds and mutual funds. And eventually we then became investment managers ourselves. And then I joined Magellan. I think there's very much an argument for both. The argument ultimately is about the income streams and whether you're listed or unlisted. In the long run, that shouldn't matter. In the short run, well, clearly listed's liquid. So you can get in and get out. It's very difficult to actually get invested in unlisted infrastructure, certainly if you've got any size. In addition to which, in listed, you can get invested across geographies and across sectors. So you can get a very diversified spread of investments quite quickly. And then finally, listed has historically been cheaper than unlisted, pound for pound. It's not always going to be the case, but certainly over the last decade, I think pretty much anyone who's looked at the stats, the simple earnings multiples that assets have been acquired at, would come to the conclusion that listed has been cheaper than unlisted. Now, on the flip side, I think the big advantage unlisted investors have is that they can control agency risk. I've already mentioned in your quick questions that agency risk is the big red flag. The nature of an unlisted investment is that you can make sure that the shareholders' agreement it requires that excess cash flows or cash flows generally get returned to shareholders. In the listed world, you have much less control over management and board, and therefore they can head off and look to diversify, as we talk about. So that can be an issue. So they're the relative benefits and weaknesses. We have sit in a lot of superannuation fund or pension fund portfolios around the world, often side by side with unlisted. And you know, unlisted, as I say, it certainly has a place in a portfolio, and I think listed does as well. It gives, in particular in those larger portfolios, it gives them some liquidity that can move over time. And we've certainly seen that during the pandemic. You know, a number of those investors have found themselves up against liquidity issues and have needed to sell some stuff along the way. And we've seen that in our own portfolios over that time.
So you've got that kind of flexibility of changing assets at different times. Did you do much of that during March and April?
Yeah, absolutely. So coming into the pandemic, we had our portfolio was roughly 55% infrastructure and about 41-42% utilities. But if I go back a step, our universe is actually sort of diametrically opposite that. Our universe is about 60% utilities and 40% infrastructure.
And so what do you put into those buckets? It's probably a good point.
Yes, well, utilities are gas, electricity, water. Regulated income streams, they typically are permitted by the regulator to earn a sort of a fair return. So let's call that, 8-9% on their capital. And the regulation is, as far as we're concerned, is very much your friend. It makes sure that you earn that fair return over time. So that's the utilities bucket. Infrastructure is about the movement of people, of goods, or of data, at providing an essential service. So these are toll roads, airports, ports, rail, communications infrastructure, the movement of data over time, places, and energy infrastructure, the movement of oil or gas through pipelines or networks. And typically what you're getting in each of these situations is a price that is regulated. The toll, if you like, is regulated, the toll on a toll road, the charge you pay going through a through an airport. But there's no overall limitation on earnings. So your earnings will rise and fall as your volumes do, as your passengers through an airport or traffic on a road or so on. So one's regulated utilities have very much regulated earnings, very reliable earnings, but no volume growth. Infrastructure has a regulated price typically, or a contracted price, but has volume growth and therefore can earn high and growing return on capital. So typically what we've found over the more than 10 years we've been operating the fund is that those things that appeal to us as investors more than the market, as it were. In other words, what are those things where we've seen opportunity over time? It tends to be where there's structural growth in earnings over a long period of time, and that structural growth has been underappreciated by investors generally. So if I think about Transurban, for example, or toll roads generally, we've seen structural growth, particularly in urban traffic over long periods of time, that we could believe in as we look forward, and that the investment markets haven't necessarily given a lot of credence to that. So as a result, we've typically been overweight infrastructure. Certainly over the last 5 years, we've typically held roughly 60% of our portfolio in infrastructure and closer to 40% in utilities. And that's the position that we were in coming into the pandemic earlier this year. And of that, as I said, roughly 55% in infrastructure and 41, 42 in utilities at that time. Of the 55% in infrastructure, around about 19% was in airports. And the weight of our universe in airports is more like 10%. So we were heavily overweight airports. We had holdings in six different airports. And with the benefit of hindsight, that was clearly an error. This is not something we saw coming, and that hurt us, and it hurt us in a big way through that period. Airports to this.
Hindsight, what was the probability of a
absolutely.
Pandemic in your modeling beforehand?
It's something we'd talked about in the past, but what we certainly didn't see is the correlation to one of global airports. And now knowing that a pandemic, as it's turned out, was a certainty for this year, we certainly weren't allowing for that level of probability. What we did as the pandemic became apparent to us in sort of January, February, we had thought slash hoped that it would be a China issue, not necessarily go beyond China. And certainly in the past with SARS and the like, these sorts of health issues had been contained to singular areas. So we were operating on that basis. And that led us to sell some of the airports that were exposed, particularly to Chinese passengers, so Sydney Airport, Auckland International Airport, for example. When it became clear it was a global issue, then we significantly reduced our weighting to airports. We went from 19% airports down to about 5 or 6, so 12-13% reduction in our weighting. And that meant that our weighting to infrastructure fell from 55% down to about 42% through that period. At the point at which we made that trade, we let our cash increase. So we went significantly more defensive, and subsequently we've then reduced the weighting to cash as we've gone back into, in particular, the utilities. And utilities today are about 46-47% of our portfolio. Cash at that, sorry, infrastructure is still at that sort of 42-43, and cash at about 10. And we're just gradually reallocating that cash back towards those things where we think that there is limited downside, but certainly some upside. And for us, that's very much the utilities bucket just at the moment. We see significant opportunity in utilities relative to where we've seen that before. And so that's progressively where we've been allocating over the last sort of 6 months, really.
That seems to be working. You're about 400 to 500 basis points above the relevant index in the last 12 months.
It's working, but we're not happy with the returns that we've generated through the period. The returns are negative, so we're certainly not crowing about that. Yes, we're doing better than the index, but we would hope to do a lot better than that as well. And in particular, in down markets, we've traditionally sought to structure the portfolio so it does relatively well in down markets. So that's, I guess, sort of pleasing, but I don't feel pleased in any way, shape, or form about what's gone on in the last 6 months. I like to say that with infrastructure, these are generally very boring companies, and the ideal day for me should be a very boring day at work. These companies should be
I
generating
like it.
very reliable, predictable earnings. But unfortunately, this year there's been way too much excitement.
One of the things, Gerald, when we selected your fund, when we did due diligence on the universe and then decided which fund we would put in our model portfolio, it was very clear from Magellan's perspective to us, there was three things that you seek in infrastructure assets. And they seemed to be really clear. They resonated with us as a firm. We're a relatively conservative firm. You talked about monopolistic assets, consistency and regulated income, and the third one being not linked to commodity prices. And essentially, the last one is probably what that made us, decide that this was the fund for us. Do any of those three things change post-COVID versus pre-COVID? Has a monopolistic asset, Melbourne Airport sits idle here. I know you don't own it, but essentially it's still monopolistic. Have you rethought those three things, or you think they will hold strong in normal times or post-COVID times?
I think we'd be strongly of the view that each of those criteria remains appropriate. clearly at the moment, there's, you know, it's just, let me go back a step. I mentioned the infrastructure is about the transport of, you know, people and goods. In a situation where there's a physical lockout of commerce, then that's not real good for things that are involving the physical transport of people and goods. So yeah, airports, toll roads, rail to some degree have all faced issues in the short term, but we're strongly of the view that these things will come back. Now they may come back slightly rebased. If I think about airports, there are sort of three types of travellers. Leisure, you know, people on holidays, visiting friends and relatives, and business. And it would, you know, as people get used to the Zoom calls, to the Microsoft Teams calls, it's certainly plausible that there'll be less business travel going forward. So perhaps a portion of that travel rebases, but we're confident that passengers will come back to 2019 levels, albeit with something of a lag. IATA, the global airline lobbying group, has their forecasts are that passengers will come back to 2019 numbers in somewhere around the 2023-2024 mark, so a 4 to 5 year sort of high recovery period. And that's very long dated in terms of what we've seen traditionally in aviation, but we certainly don't believe aviation's going away.
Maybe a different lens, you know, I saw the numbers from Perth Airport that are servicing obviously the resource sector, and they look pretty strong given
And in China domestic travel sort of essentially, you know, somewhere between zero, it's almost flat to maybe 5% down, somewhere in that range at the current time. So you're seeing people come back, but it will happen slowly. In toll roads, there are two types of toll roads: interurban roads, which connect multiple towns and cities, and then urban roads. So urban roads is transurban. Transurban's traffic at its worst was down about 50 to 55%. If I exclude Melbourne, which has had the second wave, in those cities where there hasn't been a second wave, it's sort of down teens now, sort of 10 to 15%. Melbourne's worse, you know, had the second wave, it blew out a bit. In interurban roads, we saw traffic down something around 85% at the height of the pandemic, and we're now seeing it down around about 10%. In France, down about 5%, Italy, not dissimilar. Spain, again, second wave, down about 20%. So as the health outcomes gradually improve and people start coming back to work, we're confident in both those cases that we're going to see patronage numbers back to their original sort of settings. Rail, not dissimilar. Rail was down about, rail for us is US freight rail, I might add. And freight volumes were down about 30% at the height of the pandemic, and we're now seeing them down somewhere 5% or less typically. So again, a reasonably quick recovery from what was an almighty economic shock.
Now, a lot of the equity guys compared GFC to what we've just gone through in terms of drops and recoveries. Obviously, when we talk about infrastructure, it's slightly different, isn't it? Is there anything you learned through the GFC to what you learned here? Or was it more a financial structuring issue in the GFC where this is just sheer numbers have fallen off?
Yeah, look, I think with the GFC, it had been so long since we'd had a shock of that magnitude that the level of sustained panic was just lasted a lot longer. We, you know, my memory of the GFC is that we had so much volatility over such a long period of time. Here, the volatility was significant, but it was much more contained. If you look at the what markets have done did in the first quarter, and then in the second quarter, we saw absolutely massive volatility in that March period. But once we got to the second quarter, we saw something of a rebound, and then we've seen much more subdued levels of volatility subsequently. So to me, they've been quite different. There remains significant uncertainty around passenger numbers, around the travel industry, and to some degree that plays out for toll roads as well. But if I look at the rest of our universe, regulated utilities are very much on thesis. We've gone through second quarter earnings really around the world, and really pretty much all the regulated utilities that we're focused on have reiterated their earnings guidance for 2020. In other words, notwithstanding 6 months of pandemic, they're continuing to generate earnings consistent with their expectations at the start of the year. So very resilient business models. As I said, airports, toll roads a little bit differently, but utilities very consistent with what we would have expected. So If I can, you know, I compare that to the GFC. In the GFC, we saw businesses really continuing to perform very much as we expected, but share prices moving around pretty aggressively through the time. And as you say, anything with financial structuring or high levels of debt, clearly they face some issues. But if I look through that GFC period, there are really only around the world, maybe one or two, maybe three businesses that really faced that we would define as infrastructure that ultimately had any material issues. And they all had one thing in common, those three companies. They're either Australian or they're managed by Australians. And they had a high level of debt. And you know, Australia has had a history of having significant levels of gearing in what would otherwise be very dull, colourless and boring income streams, the sort that I, you know, pursue.
Okay, can we turn the conversation to green? There's obviously the world is turning green and our portfolios are turning green. Yep. So can you talk about how you guys are approaching that? Are things like solar farms an infrastructure asset, or is that a real estate asset?
We've got a question on hydrogen as well. Does that fall into the kind of infrastructure assets? I guess the movement of hydrogen or?
Let's deal with green. Let me deal with renewable energy first, then I'll talk a little bit about hydrogen. So renewable energy is really about generation, power generation. If you think about the utility industry, there's really four parts of the industry. You generate power, you send that power down high voltage transmission lines, you step that voltage down into distribution lines, which come into your home or place or business, and then someone sells you the electricity. Typically, you know, you get a call at about 7:30 on a Wednesday night, someone very kindly seeing if you want to change your electricity supply. So four distinct parts: generation, transmission, distribution, retail. That first part, generation, we don't like a lot. Not because the companies are evil, but because the price fluctuates. If you think about Australia in calendar 2018, the average price of electricity in Australia was about $90 a megawatt hour. It differs from state to state, but about $90 a megawatt hour. And compared to that average price of $90, there was a maximum price of $14,000 a megawatt hour and a minimum price of negative $550 a megawatt hour, where the electricity, you know, the power generators are paying you to run your air conditioner, if you like. So you've got a highly volatile price and therefore volatile revenues and earnings. So we don't want to be in generation. Transmission and distribution, natural monopolies providing an essential service, as a result regulated, that's where we want to be. And the final piece, retail, the fact that you can get a call on a Wednesday night trying to get you to change your supply tells you it's competitive, and competition is something we don't like, so we don't want to be there. So most of the utilities around the world sit in all four buckets, and our test is very simple. We want 75% of earnings to come from transmission and distribution, the regulated components.
So would batteries more likely fit into that kind of when they're at a scale?
Absolutely. So batteries are at utility scale, but you know, community scale. It would typically that would become part of what's known as the regulated asset base, the assets that the regulated utility owns, and they would earn a regulated return on that. That meets our criteria. In renewable energy, we're happy to invest in renewable energy provided there's a take or pay agreement. That is that the you've preset the price and the volume of electricity that's going to be taken.
You get paid regardless.
And therefore you don't hold risk. Yep. So provided there's a take or pay agreement more than, I would say, 10 years, probably more than 15, to be honest, then that meets our criteria. And we can see individual projects that meet that criteria, but we haven't found a company yet whose portfolio is more than, you know, even 10 years, let alone 15. So we can't invest directly in renewables. However, a number of our utilities do have renewable energy in them. And renewable energy generally is a very big theme, a positive theme for what we invest in, the poles and wires, because every time you build a new solar or wind power or biomass facility, it needs to be connected to the grid. And when you connect it to the grid, you've got to spend money, you've got to spend capital, you've got to build the connection, and that's the transmission and distribution company building that, and that's what they get a return on. Ultimately, they get a 9% return or an 8% return on whatever they plunk into their network. So the T&D companies, the transmission distribution companies, are big beneficiaries of green, but we're not necessarily investing in renewable stuff as a standalone. So that's sort of renewables. Hydrogen, similar theme. As it pertains to the gas network. So gas networks around the world are looking at replacing part or all of their natural gas with hydrogen over time. Now, that's got to be proved up. It's going to require, I expect, some strengthening or modification of the existing gas networks, that is the pipes that move gas from gas basins to communities and then throughout the community. And it will probably require some changes to the actual equipment that we use in our houses, whether that's a gas hot water system or a gas cooktop or the like. So there's going to be some changes required. But we would expect that what that will mean, that as natural gas is replaced by hydrogen, it will mean that those companies are able to increase their usage levels over time. Natural gas has some greenhouse gas issues. It's clearly a transition fuel to get us to a net zero carbon future. So it's not going away in a hurry, but to the extent that natural gas can be replaced by hydrogen, that's very beneficial for these companies, 20, 30, 40 years into the future.
Yeah.
So do we invest in standalone hydrogen? No, but and frankly, there are no opportunities to invest in standalone hydrogen for us at the moment. But the gas companies are all spending a lot of money trying to work out exactly how they're going to implement hydrogen into their networks.
And you're very aware of the theme that's
absolutely
that's
completely. A couple of years ago, there was a lot of discussion about autonomous vehicles. That was a constant topic of discussion. And we thought at the time that the world had reached peak autonomous vehicle. That is, the enthusiasm for autonomous vehicles had gotten a little bit ahead of reality. And we do expect autonomous vehicles will be there in the future, but it's going to take time.
They're still going to pay tolls, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. Hydrogen is a bit the same. Hydrogen holds a lot of promise, and there's a lot of material in the media at the moment on hydrogen and investment reports on it, but it's a very long-dated opportunity.
Assume the companies that you hold have assets in emerging markets as well. So do you have a split between emerged markets and emerging markets of where the underlying assets are held, not where the companies are listed, but where the underlying assets are held?
Yeah, look, the bulk of our companies don't hold too much in emerging markets. The overwhelming bulk of these companies, because the overwhelming bulk of these companies are single jurisdictional in their nature. And why? When you think about an infrastructure company or an infrastructure asset, it involves building a big, ugly piece of equipment in a single place. A lot of money out the door on day one and a long series of cash flows into the future. So some of these companies have gone on to build stuff in and own stuff in emerging markets, but not a lot. Our exposure to emerging markets would look through basis would be less than 10% of the portfolio.
So political and geopolitical risk in your portfolio is minimal.
We're still risking developed markets.
Provided we believe
like political risk, that's right.
The risk in the US and the UK and Europe is low.
Okay. It's a good point.
Who knows?
It wasn't that long ago where we, as investors, were particularly concerned about the UK. So coming up to the election, the UK elections last year, we actually exited the overwhelming bulk of our UK exposures, which were UK utilities. Because in the event that Mr. Corbyn got elected, that the UK Labour Party got elected, they had said that they would nationalise the utilities, and they would do so at net assets. And these assets typically trade at 1.3, 1.4 times net tangible assets. And therefore, if you're an owner of those assets, you are staring an opportunity loss of sort of 30 to 40% in the face. Now, we didn't expect that they were going to get elected. We thought that there was a low probability, but it was a low probability with a pretty high impact. So we felt that the sovereign risk was a little bit high at that time.
You don't trust polls anymore anyway, do we?
No, well, I must admit, if there's a lesson I've learned about politics in the last 5 years, it's polls are not necessarily a good guide to the future. So we understood when we did that it would potentially hurt our portfolio in a relative sense through that time, and it probably did. Not catastrophic, but it would have been better to be in those assets. But the downside for us was too significant. Generally speaking, yes, the level of political and geopolitical risk should be relatively low in this portfolio. And certainly, we don't invest in China, we don't invest in Russia, because we can't trust the legal frameworks to protect our rights. Again, we're not saying companies in those jurisdictions are poor investments, but they're not reliable and predictable. They're not boring in the way that we need them to be.
Maybe we go into companies, Jamie, a few companies.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea. One of the problems we have as financial planners, Gerald, is when we decide to outsource or partner with a fund manager like yourself, the client in their portfolio will see a line that says Magellan Infrastructure. And, you know, what's under that? Obviously, there's a portfolio of great companies. So next 20 minutes, we just want to talk about stocks that you hold and what they do and pick your minds about that. So do you want to kick that off, Drew?
I might steal your one, which is pretty interesting. You were talking about kind of new infrastructure and data. So I think, is it Charter Communication or Crown Castle, sorry?
Crown Castle, yep. Yeah, so as I mentioned, infrastructure is about the movement of people, goods and data. And communications is infrastructure is very much about the movement of data. If you think about where we all were 5 or let's say 10 years ago, let's go back into the ancient history, 10 years ago, and the way that people use their mobile phones today compared to where they were historically, they're using a lot more video, they're using their phone as ubiquitous, it's almost like another appendage, it's attached to them. The level, and now we're doing these calls all the time as well. So the level of data that's been coming through networks over time has grown at something like 40 to 50% for about the last decade. So there's been an explosion in the amount of data being pushed through communications networks, and that's only expected to increase at pretty strong rates, in particular because of the move to 5G. As we move to 5G, that will be very much about the Internet of Things, the connected devices, and that's combined with, again, increasing penetration of video and the like. You're going to see mobile telephony and broadband continue to grow the levels of data being pumped through communication networks at significant rates. And to achieve that, you need to invest in a significant manner in communications infrastructure. And the most obvious form of that is the mobile phone towers. Mobile phone towers are essentially vertical real estate. That is, you put up a tower, and once you've put up that tower, is you're leasing places on that tower to different telecommunications companies. So that they pay, they rent really a part of a space on that tower, and they'll make multiple rentals as they need multiple pieces of equipment. So that's what communications infrastructure is about. It's not just towers, it's fiber, it's small cells, these things that sort of often sit on the top of light lamp poles and electricity posts and so on. All those are pieces of equipment that enable mobile telephony and broadband. And as I say, the underlying trends for that are just incredibly attractive.
And you look at something like the NBN as well, not that it's for sale yet, but
NBN would arguably sit in that
pricing.
The issue originally they did talk about either IPOing it at some point or certainly making it available. On the basis of what we can see, the returns available from that asset would lead to a pretty significant loss on the capital that's been deployed there. But we'll have to just wait and see in the future. Volumes maybe would take off through the NBN. Apart from which, it would appear that with the advent of 5G, mobile telephony is actually going to be quicker than the NBN. But again, we'll just have to wait and see. Either way, when it comes to communications infrastructure assets, they've got an incredibly attractive fundamental story to tell. And as a consequence, this year, these assets are up around, on average, about 30%. Now, there's only 5 to 10 of these companies in the world, in listed markets in the world. So it's not a huge grouping, but they're all up very strongly because the volume trends are undeniable. The future is clearly advantage to these businesses.
We're seeing modems that now switch between wired and wireless almost seamlessly, aren't they? Which is just increased the market.
Yeah.
So the stock is Crown Castle.
We're in Crown Castle today. It's been a top 10 position for us for probably the last 5 years at least. There are three major tower companies rather in the US: Crown Castle, American Tower, and SBA Communications. There's a couple of companies in Europe, Cellnex, which is really going down a path of acquiring lots of towers from different companies. So it's a sort of an industry roll-up situation, along with Inwit, an Italian company over there, and they're looking to be additional new offerings. A number of the telco companies are looking at spinning out their tower portfolios into standalone entities in the future. So it's a space that's highly attractive and looks like it'll continue to grow.
Another one I was, have you got one, Jamie, or?
No, go for it.
Another one I was looking at yesterday was Red Electrica. So yep. I think everyone's probably read about the $1 trillion stimulus package in Europe that's being, you know, targeted towards clean energy, more sustainable businesses. So can you, I think it's a Spanish electricity utility expanding into renewables?
Yeah, well, they do a little bit of renewable stuff, but really what they are ultimately is electricity transmission grid.
Yeah.
So they own the transmission grid across the length and breadth of Spain. Spain was a very early adopter of renewable energy, and there was a lot of government incentive, I guess, provided tax incentives and the like, and pricing incentives to renewable energy, and in particular to wind. So significant amount of investment in wind energy in Spain, and as a consequence, you need a significant, an efficient, effective network to get the energy from wind, from the wind facility, or indeed if solar, if you're using it, to the ultimate consumers. And so Red Electrica has invested over really the last 10, 15 years, significant amounts of capital in its network, and will need to continue to do so to connect these sources of renewable energy to the grid. So it holds a highly attractive position. We kind of like Red Electrica because, relative to where it's been historically, because the regulatory system in Spain was, a little bit agricultural up until 2 or 3 years ago. It always seemed to work out for the best, but the rules were not necessarily clear. And when it comes to investing in regulated utilities, generally what we want to understand, what we want to see, is that there's a set of rules and that they played by the rules over time. In Spain, there wasn't really a set of rules, and you know, they sort of moderated the rules as they went along. As I said, it always seemed to work out for the best, but they've now put in place a set of rules that are much more rigorous and robust. And so we find that situation quite attractive. It's a significant position. They do have some renewable energy, not a lot, but we're not really in there for the renewable energy. What we're there for is the thematic that as the renewable energy sector continues to grow in Spain, that they're going to need to continue to invest significant amounts of money in that network. And in particular, in an effort to move to net zero, all countries probably need to do this. They all need to invest significant amounts of money, capital, in their electric transmission networks to make them as ubiquitous and effective and efficient as possible. So that's what we like about Red Electrica.
So kind of same idea here with our transmission lines, where the more capital you invest, the more... Not you can charge, but the more you can be rewarded as long as that capital is appropriate.
Absolutely. So the norm, a standard normal company normally, you know, makes whatever it's making, if it's a manufacturer, let's say, and then goes out and tries to sell it. And the difference between it, what it sells it for, its revenues and its costs, that's its profit. With a regulated electricity utility, the regulator says you're allowed to earn, let's call it 9% on whatever you've got invested in the network. So if you've got $1 billion invested in the network, you're allowed to price your product so that you earn 90 million of profit. 2 billion in the network, 180 million of profit. So you actually know your earnings ahead of time, essentially, with a high degree of confidence. And if you do better on cost than what they expected, you do a little bit better. If you do worse on cost, you do a little bit worse. But that's, you know, it's a very different scenario to your standard company. Much more, you have much higher degree of confidence in your earnings, provided you're an efficient operator. So that's, if you like, that's what we're looking for. As I said, we want to make sure that there's a set of rules and that the regulator has played by the rules over time. And then we're looking for the most efficient operators that we can find around the world within that construct.
Does that mean a lot of, historically, there's been a lot of government influence in creating these infrastructure assets?
Yep.
You know, there's not a lot of greenfield funds or shares we can buy that says, hey, if over the next 20 years we're going to spend $25 billion to build a infrastructure asset. So at the moment, there's a bit of conversation about gas and the government saying, yep, if it's not built, you know, we will build it. Is there still a role for governments to provide greenfield infrastructure and then turn it into a more commercial asset?
Absolutely. Greenfield infrastructure is quite a different risk, or faces quite a different set of risks to brownfield infrastructure, to infrastructure that's operating. you only have to look at toll roads. Greenfields toll roads have been, some of them have been fantastic and some of them have been pretty ordinary. And that's because whether or not traffic turns up in the early days has proven to be quite variable. Generally, the long-term traffic forecasts have generally proven to be quite reliable and predictable, but that sort of the penetration curve, the ramp up, the traffic ramp up curve in the early times has been found itself very difficult to predict. So, and you see this with energy as well, that there are various places where the end investor, the ultimate investor for a very reliable, predictable income stream is not the same investor as those investors who are willing to take development risk along the way. So I think in that situation, absolutely, there's a place for government. We're seeing it here in New South Wales, I'm in Sydney today, with the development of the toll road network in Sydney. The government's essentially gone through and built a lot of it, and is once the traffic ramps up, then it's selling it off. In this case, or has up to this point to Transurban, and other assets to come. And really what they're doing is they're taking on those development risks, and they should get a return on those development risks, provided their assessment of those risks is appropriate. So in that way, I think there are certainly a bunch of assets where government can participate. It's better for the community in that you actually get infrastructure happening, and government can make profits on the way through. But your ultimate end clientele for these assets is a very is an investor who's after regular, reliable returns with regular, reliable income. I think there's a.
Of course, the government's cost of debt is cost of capital is incredibly low compared to
particularly at the moment.
I sat in a fantastic debate about 5 years ago between Sir Rod Eddington and David Walsh, the owner of Mona. And obviously what he's done with his own private capital to boost Hobart and Tasmania as an art centre, and he's talking about his return on capital versus the government's return on assets. It was fascinating to see those two different people kind of approach the same issue from totally different angles.
Yeah, so, different perspectives. Yeah. Absolutely.
Drew, do you have another stop?
I had one more, which I got two more, but I'll go with one of them. So I think you had one of the few kind of assets that benefited from negative oil prices. I can't pronounce the first part of it, but Vopak.
Let's just call them Vopak. Yeah, so Vopak is a series of oil, gas and chemical terminals or tanks that typically sit in or around ports. So that can be oil, it can be oil, hydrocarbon product, I guess, if you like, oil, gas and similar, but as well chemicals. And so as oil prices have fallen, oil producers and gas producers, for that matter, have tended to take a view that they don't want to sell the product now. They have a view that oil prices will rise in the future. So they've looked to store some of that product. They'll either reduce their production, but if they can't reduce their production or they can't sell all their production, they'll store that product. So we've seen the occupancy levels in those tanks rise through the period. That hasn't been an extraordinary trend, but we've certainly seen those occupancy levels rise. There are, for Vopak, I think their storage occupancy at the end of last year was approximately 85%, and it's now approximately 90%. So it's increased about 5 percentage points through the period.
And they kind of booked out in advance. Is it like a subscription model for?
They have a right, as you sort of expect. They have a range of contracts. I think their average weighted contract is something like four to 5 years. But they have some contracts that are, spot. They're just for very short periods of time. And similarly, they have then contracts that can be, 25 years duration. So it depends on who the counterparty is. You have counterparties who include, large oil majors, the BPs of this world, if you like, who also have their own facilities, I might add. And you also then have just traders taking a view that they're going to buy oil today at a low price and sell it in 3 months' time at a higher price.
And they're just sometimes they have to take delivery. That was the issue, wasn't it?
Exactly. So they have a range of different contracts. Yes, the average length of a contract is, measured in years. But they have some short-term contracts as well as long-term.
Yeah, we've got a question from the audience, another one. Does the proposed Star of the South wind project fall into the same sort of category as your earlier comment on preference for T&D versus generation or retail?
Sorry, the proposed Star of the South wind
Star project. Of the South.
Star Sounds of the like South. A... Do you know that project at all, Gerald, or it might be a bit
No,
early?
I don't know that one. That's a wind project in Victoria, I take it?
Correct, yes.
Yeah, yeah. So that's consistent with the way that we would think about renewable energy. I don't know that particular project. So typically,
I think it's offshore Gippsland.
Right.
It's got approval. It's going to be built over the next 5 years.
Yeah. So typically those projects, by the time that they're constructed, you have a customer who's going to commit to the bulk of the demand that comes out of that project. So, you know, maybe 70% of the electricity that gets produced will be pre-committed to by an end customer. So you're dealing with much of your price risk there. As I say, at an individual level, those projects can meet our criteria. What we're investing is not necessarily in a single project, but in companies that own portfolios of these projects, and we need the average length of that of those project contracts to be 10 or more years. So that project by itself probably meets our criteria. That is an unlisted project, not rather than a listed project. So we can't invest in that one, but it could actually meet our criteria if it was available. As I said, I'm not necessarily sure of the details on that one.
So what sort of, how many, we're probably going over time, but do many new opportunities come into listed markets every year, or is the universe more shrinking than growing?
Look, it's been relatively stable. We saw a bit of shrinkage post the GFC. If you think back to the GFC, as I said, there were some companies that got buffeted around by share prices, but their underlying fundamentals didn't really change too much. And what that led to was some smart private players and pension funds then snapping some of those assets up. So Connect East in Melbourne would be a good example of that. Now owned by pension funds, a group of pension funds. Subsequent to that, we've generally seen relative stability in the size of the market. We've seen the odd thing get taken out by private guys, but by the same token, we've seen new companies come to market. AENA, the Spanish airport system, got IPO'd by the Spanish government. We've seen Cellnex, which we touched on before in the communications infrastructure world. Cellnex got spun out of a corporate. So we've seen companies come out of the corporate world or new IPOs come to market. We've also seen companies that failed our test sell some of the stuff that failed our test. Utilities in particular sell some of their generation because they wanted to be pure T&D. So we've seen some of that. And on the flip side, as I said, we've seen companies taken out because of M&A activity or they bought things that failed our test. So the total size of our universe is somewhere been in the range of 130 to 140 companies pretty consistently over the last 5 to 10 years.
Thanks, Gerald. We're definitely running out of time, but we do like and continue to like the assets that you buy, the monopolistic kind of structure of those assets, the consistent income stream. And, you know, if I bring up my Morningstar reports, you know, you've done a great job over a long period of time. People will ask, well, you could index the exposure over 10 years, you've added about 400 basis points and through the category. So when you look at Morningstar, when Drew and I look at Morningstar looking at funds, you get a category, which is all active infrastructure funds in the universe you can pick from. You've outperformed that by about 170 basis points after fee. So it obviously means that keeping you into the portfolio and being a part of our portfolio is relatively easy when you push out numbers like that. So well done to you and your team. Really appreciate you being here and taking your time, an hour and a half of your time to talk to us and to our clients. It means a lot to us. It means a lot to our clients. So thank you, Gerald.
No problem, Jamie.
You can hear lots of people clapping.
Always happy to talk to you guys.
Excellent.
Thanks, mate. So for the listeners, that's the first in our series. Next week, we have Nanook Nanook Asset Management talking about how COVID has affected green investing and what has changed within Tom King's portfolio. So please join us again. Thanks very much. Thanks, Drew. Thanks, Gerald.
Thank you. Thanks, Scott. Jamie. Cheers.